A new book by a University of Hawaii economist chronicles the 800-year political and economic history of society in the Hawaiian Islands. Sumner LaCroix is an emeritus professor and research fellow with the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. But fitting 800 years into 10 minutes of radio is a tall order, so we're going to bring you the highlights from each era of history. We begin at the beginning.
One of the things that we're learning about Hawaii is that people came to Hawaii an awful lot later than we thought they did. We thought that the Polynesians came to Hawaii, say, in the area of 300, 400, 500 AD. But now we're learning that they really came more in the area of 1100, 1200, 1250 AD. I mean, that's 700, 800 years later. So there's really a much shorter history of Hawaii than we think. The Polynesians that first came to Hawaii actually brought very established political institutions and cultures with them. And they then adapted those institutions to the situation in Hawaii. Hawaiians essentially reconfigured the islands into a network of extremely productive farms that left Hawaii a relatively well-off society. They're able to have very extensive networks of taro farms. And the taro farms tend to produce a lot of food per worker put into the taro field. A single worker could support from 5 to 10 people. So that meant that you could support a population of artists, religious specialists, politicians, fishermen. I mean, you could support all sorts of people that become the mix for relatively advanced culture. With the centralization of government under Kamehameha, the 19th century essentially saw this vast fall in Hawaiian population. If we're looking at the population between 1778, we're still debating how many people were here during that period, but I think somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 people were here in the islands. And all of a sudden, the native Hawaiian population is down to less than 50,000 at the turn of the 20th century. That's a massive decline in populations, and it's mostly due to diseases that are introduced from the West. And that creates crises in Hawaiian society. And the crises come because chiefs, who previously had a very ample labor force. That's a pretty good population for Hawaii, 400 to 500,000 on the eve of contact. Today, we only have 1.4 million. So it says there's a lot of people here at contact with the West. I mean, that population basically disappears. And for the chiefs, that means there's no one to work their lands. In the early 19th century, they start looking for other opportunities. I mean, one opportunity was sandalwood. One opportunity is whaling. But those are really opportunities that outsiders are controlling. Sandalwood is very limited because you're harvesting a limited stock of sandalwood. The whaling trade, you're basically limited to servicing the whaling ships. A lot of Hawaiians become sailors on those ships. And so they're looking for something where their lands can be worked. And sugar is one of the things all of a sudden they start to realize that if they can start sugar plantations, that now that their lands can come back into production.
A boom in the demand for foreign sugar during the U.S. Civil War establishes a close trading relationship between the Kingdom of Hawaii and the United States. But when the war ends, Hawaii has to compete with cheaper sugar being produced in the American South. So Hawaii negotiates a free trade agreement with the U.S. in order to remain competitive.
Hawaii was really not that well suited for sugar production. Yes, there would have been some sugar production in Hawaii, but it wouldn't have been the massive producer of sugar that it became in some sense. We would have found that that the U.S. mostly imported sugar from the Caribbean, where there was much lower cost production in the Caribbean. And Hawaii is the only place that's able to come in under the U.S. tariff umbrella. And the U.S. tariff umbrella is high, so they impose 40% tariffs. So what that essentially means is that the price which is garnered by a sugar producer in Hawaii is approximately 40% higher than the price that a sugar producer in Jamaica or Cuba. That's a massive premium. What happens is that also means Hawaii becomes very dependent on the U.S. market. And as it becomes dependent on the U.S. market, that actually leaves a lot of power with the U.S. government. And when the treaty is up for renewal in the mid-1880s, the U.S. government looks at the treaty and says, we should be able to squeeze more out of the Hawaiians. They're very dependent on us. And so the government asks that the U.S. warships be allowed to establish coaling stations in Pearl Harbor. And then in Hawaii, there's tremendous controversy about that. A lot of people believe this is going to be a loss of sovereignty. It's eventually going to lead to annexation by the United States. It leads to some political turmoil. And when it looks like the Hawaiian government and the king, Kalakaua at the time, are not going to agree to the change, then a small group of white residents of the islands comes and confronts the king. An armed group comes and confronts the king and demands that he did he sign a treaty that involves this cession of rights to the United States? And Kalakaua does. And that's really the definitive moment. The annexation, I think, just kind of comes naturally after that.
The outbreak of the Spanish-American War does spur annexation and the beginning of the territorial era, or as Sumner calls it, the colonial period.
Once the U.S. takes over, I mean, essentially there's a colonial government in Hawaii. The United States president appoints the governor. The United States president essentially appoints the Supreme Court justices. Yeah, there's an elected legislature, but the electorate is quite diminished. Essentially, what we have in this colonial government is we end up with political coalitions that just encompass the big interests. That's mostly the big five corporations that are controlling the sugar industry. The U.S. military becomes a big interest as they start to expand bases in Hawaii during that period. The next 61 years, the period 1898 all the way through 1959 when statehood comes, I think in many ways is kind of a dark period for Hawaii because it really is a time when Hawaii was ruled as a colony from Washington, D.C. for all intents and purposes. And on the flip side, there's a silver lining to that period. And the silver lining to the period was that in some ways parts of the U.S. Constitution applied. And because parts of the U.S. Constitution applied, it was very difficult to limit groups forming that pushed for a better government to be established in Hawaii. The colonial period, too, I think, is also marked by the disaster of World War II for Hawaii. And the disaster of World War II doesn't just come with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It also comes with the martial law that was imposed after the bombing. The martial law that's imposed in the islands is far different than the U.S. imposed anywhere else. The civilian government is totally dismantled. The civilian courts are totally dismantled. If you have a traffic ticket, it's held before a military court. Every single action is essentially judged by the military. And I think by the end of the war, people kind of realized that you know, they really were not living in a place where they had any type of self-government. And then after the war, there's a series of very difficult strikes in Hawaii, strikes by workers who felt that they deserved higher wages, the dock workers, an ILWU-led strike, the pineapple workers and the sugar workers. All of them got higher wages. It also imposed a lot of costs on Hawaii, just in the sense that Hawaii kind of got a reputation for not a place that you could do business. And this is a period before the tourists had really started to arrive, before the jet planes.
But eventually, the jets full of tourists do come, as did the movement for statehood.
The transition from a colonial order to statehood is a really rough transition in some ways. In Hawaii, it came suddenly. One day, we have a governor who's appointed by the president. We have courts that are essentially appointed from the outside. And all of a sudden, there's a new sovereign state where the governor's elected, the courts are appointed by the governor and confirmed by our own Senate. That's really a massive transition. You really start to see the decline of the sugar economy come the 1980s and 1990s. I mean, over that period, really a lot of the sugar plantations start to close. And I think in some ways the sugar industry was kind of an artificial industry in Hawaii. To a very large extent, it was the product of U.S. protectionism, basically taking measures to artificially heighten the price of sugar. And without that quota and tariff system, I don't think Hawaii ever would have had the huge sugar economy that it ended up with. The price realized by sugar slowly declined over time. Costs in Hawaii seem relatively high compared to places like Thailand or Guatemala. And so for a whole number of reasons, the sugar and pineapple industry declined. There is no sugar industry in Hawaii today, and only the very small remnants of a pineapple industry.
So, what comes next for the Hawaiian Islands?
You know, I think it's easy to look at the current system and say that we have lots of problems. It's interesting how disastrous, in many ways, our tourism strategy has been. Nowadays, we still have some high-end tourists. All you have to do is walk down Kalakaua Avenue. But we also have lots and lots and lots of tourists who come here and really don't spend much money. They're staying out relatively cheap accommodations. They're not spending much money, and they're putting a lot of stress on the infrastructure. And this is the type of model that Hawaii has to get a handle on. The internet has left us in a rough position there. We really need to take better measures to make sure that our environment is maintained. And we do need to remember, too, that people come out here because of the amazing natural environment and partly, too, because of the host Hawaiian culture. I do think as far as alternative industries go, the number one thing that we need to try to do is to make sure that Hawaii is a friendly place for business, for startups, and for companies to start to reach some maturity. I still think we have a ways to go on that. There's a potential to have a high-tech industry here. And in the past, we've really had a rough time trying to find what's the right road to stimulate a high-tech industry. Today, what we need to be looking at are small nudges that will help some of these industries. We need to be asking how our infrastructure supports these industries. And we just need to be careful about picking the exact industries for the future. What we really need to be doing is to be laying in the infrastructure so that new firms find this a hospitable place to start up new ventures.
The book is called Hawaii, 800 Years of Political and Economic Change. Sumner LaCroix is the author. Sumner, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.